Hello.
Hi.
Justice, you are live in the hearing room.
Thank you.
Reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, we have a couple of preliminary matters. First of all, my notes tell me we have Ripon College Pre-Law Society students here. If that's correct, would you all please stand? Very good. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here in a program we operate in conjunction with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they know a little bit about what you're going to be arguing to us today. And they did meet with Justice Michael Gableman over the lunch hour to tell them a little bit more about how the Supreme Court fits within the other courts in Wisconsin, and I'm sure some other pearls as well. You'll notice that on the bench we are sitting five. We are sitting six for decisional purposes. Justice Shirley Abrahamson is on the phone, so if you hear a voice from above, that's Justice Abrahamson asking for a question. Justice Annette Ziegler, who is not on the bench today, is not participating in this case. Let's see here. So with those preliminary matters in place, I'll call the last case of the day, McAdams versus Marquette University. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Good afternoon. Marquette made broad promises to Dr. McAdams.
Make sure you speak up, counsel.
It told him that he could not be suspended or terminated for exercising his right of legitimate academic and personal expression. It promised that termination would not be used to restrain conduct protected by the First Amendment. John McAdams wrote a blog post about a matter of frequent public concern, the proper scope of academic discourse, and the way in which he and others believe that many in the academy seek to suppress discourse in the guise of fighting what they see as oppression or protecting from offense. Now, this case, given these promises, is not about whether we agree with what Dr. McAdams wrote or whether we would have done it differently. We don't get to that issue unless we can conclude that his post, on its face, was so objectionable that it falls outside this broad protection.
Counsel, is it accurate to characterize the blog post as an extramural comment?
I think it is an extramural comment. In this instance, he was speaking as a citizen of the community, and he commented on a matter of great public concern.
And I understand that within the concept of academic freedom, there are three different levels of protection afforded depending on the nature of the communication. And is it correct that extramural comments enjoy the lowest protection?
Yes, I think that that's right. Only in the rarest of circumstances can someone be disciplined for an extramural comment.
And are extramural comments subject to a balancing test?
If they are subject to a balancing test, it cannot be a plenary, open-ended, subjective balancing test that treats the right to speak as only one consideration among many, conflates criticism with harm, and holds someone responsible for the reaction of others. Any balancing test would have to be weighted heavily in favor of the speaker, and it seems to me would have to be clearly limited by resort to ex ante, clear and narrow rules that do not significantly limit the scope of discourse. I think that's necessary in this case and consistent, quite frankly, with what courts have learned over the years about protecting the freedom of expression, because without that, no speaker can know what he or she can say.
So let's camp on that for just a second. You say if it is subject to a balancing test, then this is what you need to do. Is it subject to a balancing test?
I think that I think it would be necessary for there to be some ex ante, clear and narrow limitation on speech that a speaker would be presumed to know.
And what
some of those might involve the application of a balancing test. Well, for example, if the speech was defamatory, or if the speech incited immediate violence, or perhaps if the speech constituted fighting words.
Okay.
The point that I think is important here is that because of the nature of academic freedom, which is by intrinsically a protection against not only the institution, but against one's colleagues. It is the right to say something that is unpopular and which other people disagree with and believe that you should not have said, because, quite frankly, only unpopular speech will ever be disciplined.
My understanding of the university's argument is that one of the things to be balanced against the extramural comment in the academic freedom equation is harm to others. Is that your understanding as well?
It is my understanding that is the university's position.
Right. Correct. So, I take it you have some quibble with that. What I'm interested in is if harm is a legitimate factor to weigh in that balance, what is the nature of that harm that can go into that equation?
Harm cannot be criticism. Now, it's possible that, and we know this by analogy to the First Amendment, that there are certain types of speech that we think are intrinsically harmful in a way that permits us to limit them in ways that we otherwise could not limit speech. And I mentioned before, defamatory conduct, comments that incite immediate violence, the Brandenburg Doctrine, or the Szaplinski Doctrine of fighting words.
Is it your position, Counselor, that the rights of free speech granted to Marquette's faculty are the same as they would be were Marquette a public institution, or are they more limited, as appears to be argued by Marquette?
I think that there are two commitments that Marquette made. The first is a commitment of legitimate academic freedom and personal expression. I believe that given the nature of academic freedom and the very thing that's being promised, given the structure of the contract, and by way of analogy to other areas of the law, that protection is quite broad and may approach that provided by the First Amendment. Marquette made a second commitment. Marquette said that in no event may termination be used to restrain rights that would be guaranteed by the United States Constitution, which would, of course, include the First Amendment.
Right. So I understand that. But when I read the briefs of the parties, it appears to me that they are saying that the free speech rights, which are limited under the United States Constitution by fighting words and several other doctrines, it appears to me they're saying that they're not as expansive under the provisions that are in Professor McAdams' contract as they would be were he either an employee of a public state university or a private citizen.
Well, in this case they are, because this is a case about termination. And Marquette chose to make the commitment to its faculty members that they would not be terminated to restrain those rights.
I understand that. I'm trying to go back. I get what you're arguing about. They made the commitment. They won't terminate him for exercising his First Amendment rights. What I am looking at, and maybe I'm just not understanding counsel's argument correctly, what I'm looking at is, are the breadth of his First Amendment rights the same as I have? Well, I have somewhat limits on mine. Well, let's choose somebody else. Yeah, right. But are they the same as most folks have? Are they the same as he would if he were a professor at University of Wisconsin Law School, which is a public university? Or because of Marquette's private status or whatever, is that guarantee more narrow?
With the significance of Marquette's private status,
right,
is that the First Amendment and academic freedom rights that Dr. McAdams enjoys, he enjoys by virtue of contract. He
right.
enjoys because Marquette decided to promise
I get
them,
that.
Didn't have to, did so.
Got it.
So with respect to termination, I think that they are coterminous because Marquette, that's what Marquette said. You can't be terminated for exercising
First
Amendment
rights.
You are
either missing my question or I'm saying it clearly. No, I know he can't be terminated under the contract in your argument for exercising his First Amendment rights. My question is, what is the scope of those rights? Are they the same as if he were University of Wisconsin right, law school professor?
And with respect to termination, they are the same. With respect to academic freedom, I believe that they are to be assessed in the way that I just described to Justice Kelly. That is, that if they're subject to a balancing test, the balancing test has to be weighted heavily in favor of the speaker and has to be limited by ex ante, clear and narrow rules that do not restrict the scope of discourse. Now, whether that is in all respects coterminous with the First Amendment is a hypothetical question that I can't answer here. But what I can say here is that whatever the limitations on academic freedom, right, that aspect of the promises, because there were two promises, that whatever the limitation on the scope of academic freedom, Dr. McAdams' post falls squarely in the center of it and cannot be the basis for any type of discipline. And then, because of this additional promise with respect to termination, he enjoys First Amendment rights, which, in fact, are coterminous with those that would be enjoyed by anyone else.
I want to follow up on that question. You indicated in response initially that he enjoys these rights by virtue of the contract. So, rather than paraphrase or put new words into the contract, let's look at the words of the contract. I'm looking specifically at Section 307.07, Faculty Hearing Committee Procedure, and I'm looking at Sub 2, which deals with dismissal, and primarily the last sentence of Sub 2. Are you with me? Dismissal will not be used to restrain. I want to make sure you're following what I'm saying.
Right, I'm with you.
Okay, thank you. Dismissal will not be used to restrain faculty members in their exercise of academic freedom or other rights guaranteed them by the United States Constitution. So we have here the phrase, or other rights guaranteed them by the United States Constitution. We don't have specifically the wording First Amendment rights, which could have been garnered as the situation given some of the responses. So, or other rights guaranteed them by the United States Constitution. What is the guarantee of the First Amendment right of the United States Constitution vis-a-vis speech?
It's a broad question. First Amendment rights are quite broad.
Well,
there are exceptions.
Let's start with the language. I don't mean it to be broad. I mean it to be more narrow. The First Amendment guarantees this. Congress shall make no law respecting, goes through religion and et cetera, freedom of speech. Now, Congress, over the years since the First Amendment was enacted, has been interpreted to mean government. Government shall make no laws abridging the freedom of speech. That's the First Amendment right out of the words of the First Amendment. This is a follow-up to the questions just asked you. Is Marquette University government?
No, Marquette University is not government.
No,
but
it's a private institution. The First Amendment right is that the government can not abridge freedom of speech. There is no First Amendment right that private people can't abridge speech, is there?
No, but in the context of this contract, which involves termination,
mm-hmm.
What Marquette has done here is it has made this assurance to its faculty that it will not terminate them for rights that would have been guaranteed by the United States Constitution.
And I get back to my question. What is that right?
And
the only right is government shall not abridge the freedom of speech.
The right here, I think, is the right of freedom of speech. And
maybe.
It seems to me that it would read that provision out of the contract to say that we won't fire you because you exercise rights for exercising rights protected by the First Amendment, but then turn around and say that you cannot assert this provision as a defense because we're not the government and we don't owe you any First Amendment rights. That would be, I think, an odd interpretation of the contract that would render that commitment illusory. So
it could be. It may be odd, but it's a literal interpretation. You speak in your brief sometimes about the principles of First Amendment. They could have written in that we are going to accord you the same rights as the principles, which is a broader language, but that's not what the contract says. The contract is very specific, and it incorporates rights afforded by the Constitution. And I submit there's no constitutional right vis-a-vis free speech other than that which is implicated by government action.
I would not call an interpretation that renders a provision meaningless to be liberal.
No, I said
I would call it an interpretation which violates most canons of construction that we have.
Okay,
that's in there for a reason. It has to mean something.
Did you understand? I may have not been clear. I said literal interpretation. I don't know if you... I heard you say back liberal. I don't mean liberal interpretation.
Maybe that I misheard it.
Yes.
But I think that it is also not a literal interpretation.
Okay.
It seems to me that the plain meaning of that provision is that we're saying to you as faculty, we've promised you academic freedom, and that is quite broad. And quite frankly, we don't even have to get to this provision of the contract to rule from Dr. McAdams. But we've gone one step further, and we've said to you that with respect to termination, you cannot be terminated for rights that would be protected by the United States Constitution. I think the literal and plain meaning of that is we are taking those guarantees upon ourselves. We are making those assurances to you, and you can not only do you have academic freedom, but you can't be fired for speech that would be protected by the United States Constitution. That is how I read that language. And quite frankly, what Marquette has said is that all that means is that termination can't be pretextual. And once again, I think that interpretation of the language is wrong because that would render it illusory. If it was pretextual, there would be no basis to fire him because absolute cause or discretionary cause would not exist. Marquette has never said that by this language, they're not in some sense binding themselves to the protections that would be offered by the First Amendment. The difference that they have with us is that they say that it only protects pretextual firing. We say no. If you fire somebody for rights that are protected by the First Amendment, that is restraining those rights.
Professor, I look to the decision of the Circuit Court as well as to the faculty report, hearing committee report that was incorporated into it. And I look at the original allegations, and they include the following. That Dr. McAdams violated his, quote, obligations of accuracy, appropriate restraint, respect for the opinions of others, and integrity. The university also asserted that McAdams violated three of Marquette's guiding values, capital G, capital V, pledging personal and holistic development of students, pursuing academic excellence and educating students, nurturing an inclusive, diverse community that fosters new opportunities, partnerships, collaborations, and vigorous yet respectful debate. It goes on. He failed to exercise due care and standards of professional responsibility when he posted the teacher's complaint, the student's complaint about Ms. Will you help me with the pronunciation?
Abate.
Thank you. Ms. Abate, without any further investigation. 4, that he wrongfully and unnecessarily used Ms. Abate's name in his November 9 blog post. And finally, in an opinion, or in a sentence written perhaps by the ghost of Orwell, but his conduct contributed to a culture of intolerance. Tell me, which of these did the university settle on as far as its decision for termination?
I have a hard time reading the faculty hearing report and knowing precisely what they did settle on, because it seems to me to be sort of an amorphous, multi-part analysis in which they come to the conclusion that, well, we wouldn't have done it this way, and so therefore he can be terminated. Now, it seems to me that, as I understand Marquette's position here today, and of course Mr. Weber will state Marquette's position perhaps better than I know, is they've gotten down to the point that the only thing that he did wrong, everything was perfectly fine, but the only thing that he did wrong here is they say, inaccurately, that, or at least misleadingly, that he linked to her contact information.
Right.
The facts of the matter are as follows. He wrote a blog post on a matter of great public concern.
Well,
that blog post was inaccurate.
Let me interrupt you. What he wrote about, and I take this from the circuit court's opinion, a student in the class Theory of Ethics and the instructor, one Cheryl Abate, was attempting to apply a philosophical text to modern political controversies. So far, writes Professor McAdams, so good. And again, I'm reading from the circuit court opinion. When she came to different topics of modern political controversies, as to one in particular, she said, everybody agrees on this and there is no need to discuss it. The student made a comment after class that the issue deserved to be discussed. And here we are, linking up Orwell. Abate explained that some opinions are not appropriate. And then she invited the student to drop the class. Now, I wonder, and I'll ask Mr. Weber this question too, how this position links up with the guiding values as they are recited in the faculty report of nurturing an inclusive, diverse community that fosters, among other things, vigorous yet respectful debate. And I'm just trying to sort out how one professor writing about a report of another professor shutting down of debate can somehow be the basis of intolerance. I don't understand.
Well, and Dr. McAdams would agree with you, right? But he thought that what happened there was an example of something. It was an exercise of authority by someone who was placed in a position of authority by Marquette University.
She was a teacher. The papers have been calling her a student, but she was a teacher in that she was the teacher of that class.
With respect to that exchange, she was the teacher of that class. And so Dr. McAdams thought that he was following the guiding values of Marquette University. Now, perhaps there are others who differ with him. But the point here is that, having wrote an accurate, civil blog post, unexceptional, about a matter of great public interest, if academic freedom means anything at all, we don't even have to get to the First Amendment, although I do believe it's there. If academic freedom means anything at all, it has to mean that he cannot be fired for writing that blog post. And Marquette says, well, you know, he didn't have to identify the person that he is criticizing. But We typically identify the people that we're criticizing, and in fact, Marquette has in various forums admitted that they had no rule against someone identifying someone you're criticizing, even if they are a graduate instructor or a student.
I fail to see how we get to a term of art such as academic freedom when in the real world people call it conversation.
Yes, people call it conversation, and the purpose of academic freedom, I think, is to have a robust conversation. And robust conversations is even you sometimes I imagine you see across this bench can become excited, they can become charged, they can become heated.
Never. They are always delighted by my questions and happy to respond.
But these are the things, this is what a university is about and what academic freedom is designed to protect. And Marquette did not have to make this commitment. As a private institution, it could have chosen to operate under a different set of rules. I suppose it still could today if it wants to. But having made those commitments, it has to honor them now. And I am aware of no possible conception of academic freedom under which this blog post is not protected. I'm aware of no circumstance anywhere where somebody has been terminated for a professor.
Now, procedurally, this matter was disposed of at the summary judgment point, right?
Yes.
Was there ever an alternative or a dispute as to were there materials submitted to rebut the accuracy of the substance of the post that Professor McAdams wrote?
My red light is on.
You may answer that question.
I believe that on this record, the post was accurate.
Then that answers the question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chief Justice Rogensack and fellow justices, Ralph Weber for Marquette, a private Catholic Jesuit university. May it please the court. There are three core concepts that help the court explain and apply the rights and responsibilities that are at root issue here today. Those are shared governance, number one, academic freedom, number two, and a mutually agreed disciplinary mechanism, number three.
How about that was not an exclusive mechanism for resolving disputes between faculty and the university, correct?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about the dispute resolution mechanism contained contractually between the faculty and Marquette. That was not an exclusive forum, was it?
Well, it's an exclusive forum subject to testing the validity of by judicial review afterwards, and it's an agreed mechanism that's created through shared governance. There's a common misunderstanding for people outside the academic world that the university is simply the administration or the president, that the university is both the administration on the one hand and the faculty on the other, operating a shared enterprise which is the university. And the way the faculty exercises its power is they elect tenured colleagues to the Academic Senate. And the Academic Senate works with the administration to create what is the faculty contract. And one of the, I think, more helpful Friends of the Court briefs that you got is from the Academic Senate at Marquette.
And Mr. Weber, from the faculty report as incorporated into the circuit court opinion, the first two allegations against Professor McAdams, one included a lack of respect for the opinions of others, and the second included the guiding values, which included nurturing an inclusive, diverse community inter alia, collaboration and vigorous yet respectful debate. And then I turn to the posting, which is on the first page, recited on the first and second pages of the Circuit Court's decision and order for summary judgment, in which it is recorded that Ms. Abate, in teaching this class, simply said, as to a certain political controversy, everybody agrees on this and there is no need to discuss it. When it was pointed out by one student that at least one student thought it should be discussed, one of the responses was, some opinions are not appropriate. And in the end, she simply invited the student to drop the class. Now, is that consistent with the obligations of accuracy and respect for the opinions of others and the guiding values that the university has set forward, as you say, a private institution?
Right.
Is that all consistent with the same things that the university charged Dr. McAdams with?
Right, so two different things. With respect, and I would say this.
Do tell.
With respect to the student teacher, the apprentice teacher, a more experienced
teacher. Now, tell me exactly, apprentice teacher, what was her status?
She's a graduate student.
The record says that she was the teacher of the class.
That's right. And as between the undergraduate and her, she was his teacher.
Okay.
As between Professor McAdams and her, she was a graduate student and a student teacher.
Well, and my question to you, Mr. Weber, before it gets lost in your terminology as to her job title, is, were her actions consistent with the conduct that Dr. McAdams was charged with violating?
Well, I would put it this way.
Yes, sir.
Being secretly recorded after class by an undergraduate is not the equivalent of posting a blog post on the internet. That being said, she could have handled that exchange better. A more experienced teacher would have de-escalated the situation. And the overall context is the rights and...
So in other words, maybe a more experienced teacher would have had respect for the opinions of others and would have collaborated in a vigorous yet respectful debate? Is that what you're trying to say, Mr. Weber?
What I'm saying is, if you listen to the tape and you hear the aggressive student approach her with the audio tape recording, and until she realizes he's trying to put words in her mouth and asks if she's being taped, and he says no, and then she says, can I see your phone? And then he says, yes, I am. I'm saying, yes, a more experienced teacher would have not gotten themselves in this position. But for the purposes of this court, the rights that were created and the responsibilities that were created through this shared governance are reflected in a couple of places.
Were any actions, though, before you get to the point you want to make, I want to know, reading this record.
Yes, she was counseled and explained that the way she handled that conversation with the undergraduate was not
appropriate. Okay, so Dr. McAdams is terminated, she's counseled, and...
Well, she left the university within a matter of weeks. But, yes, she was counseled.
Was that her choice? Does the record reflect that
was her choice? It was her choice in the sense that the level of trauma was such that she found Marquette so toxic, and this is in the record.
So that was not the doing of a penalty?
No, it was not.
Right.
No.
I am very interested in the First Amendment
and
whether its scope is the same for a private university or whether it's different. And my question is, has Marquette assumed the burden that the First Amendment places on government, or has Marquette assumed a more limited burden?
It has not assumed the burden of being a governmental body.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the scope.
All right,
the scope of the First Amendment.
It is. It has not.
It has not what?
It has not assumed the scope that an employee of a governmental body would enjoy.
Okay, so it's a more limited.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. I was
yep.
trying to figure that out last time.
Yep. And again, so you start with...
Counsel, I'm sorry. I'd like to pick up on a question that Justice Bradley asked about the faculty hearing committee. I think you referred to it as the FHC in your brief, correct?
Correct.
So I'll do that as well. Is there anything in the contract where we can find some agreement that the FHC would be the exclusive mechanism for dispute resolution between professors and the university?
Yes, well, I mean, there's three different places to look for the scope of the contract. First, in the record, is the two-page agreement between the university and Professor McAdams.
Right, but can you quote me some language that says the FHC will be the exclusive remedy for disputes between the university and the professors?
Well, I think it's against the backdrop of the AAUP, American Association of University Professors, chassis that, as part of this shared governance, going back to 1915 and 1940, AAUP on the one hand and Association of American Universities representing administrators on the other jointly created these chassis of rights, so to speak, that have been adopted in different ways at different universities.
Okay,
so the context of that, yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of a specific clause that says this is the way it's exclusive remedy, but I will tell you that the whole structure of shared governance and the way these rights are created and enforced establishes that fact.
But the faculty statutes at section 30709 explicitly contemplate judicial review and judicial action, don't they? I mean, they provide, I quote, shall, until the final determination of any judicial action, hold itself ready to reinstate the faculty member in reference to the university.
That's correct.
Mr. Weber, I want to come back to one of your responses, your last response, in fact, to one of my questions, which was that Ms. Abate left the university within weeks. Doesn't the record reflect that she had been trying to transfer to other schools, in fact, for years prior to this incident?
No, Your Honor. What the record reflects is that, and she testified at the faculty hearing committee,
yes,
and I'll refer the court to her testimony at record 34, page 25.
Okay.
And would you like me to read it?
Sure.
I was scared. This is line 22 on page 83 of the transcript. I mean, the emails I was getting were very frightening. And the fact that, I mean, a few people took the time to mail me physical letters to my campus mailbox was even more frightening.
Sure.
So I was concerned for my safety. I didn't know who these people were, what they were capable of, if they lived in the area, or if they were angry enough that they would travel to the area.
But you're telling me that the record does not reflect that she had been trying to transfer to other schools prior to this incident. Is that what you're telling me, Mr. Weber?
There is an email from a professor at Boulder when this blows up who says, we had a conversation a year ago about whether you might be interested in coming to Boulder. And she responded saying, the situation in Marquette has become so toxic that I don't think I can stay here. I'm afraid to see Professor McAdams on campus. So, yes, that email is in this record.
That's all. That's all the record says about her attempts to transfer in the past.
I believe that's right.
All right.
Counsel, I'd like
to... Also in the record at 76, attached to the summary judgment briefs, are the horrific Facebook posts and the email that she got.
None of which were written by Professor McAdams, correct?
None of which were written by Professor
McAdams. Is it Marquette's position that a professor is supposed to anticipate a third party's response to his or her speech and self-censor accordingly?
The faculty hearing committee addressed this very issue at pages 58 to 60 of their report. And they found, to the clear and convincing evidence standard and unanimously, that the conduct that brings us here today is that of a professor, associate professor of political science who, one, intentionally used a student teacher's name and link to her contact information
on the
internet.
To her public blog on the internet, right?
Yes,
that was contact information?
Yes.
It wasn't her personal cell phone number or anything like that.
It was not, but the way this works is you rev up a hostile audience, you put the person's name and a way to get their contact information in front of them, and this is what results. And the Faculty Hearing Committee again said that he did this in order to expose her to negative comments, and it was his calculated goal that this would happen. And he didn't just write a blog post. Immediately after writing the blog post, he began sending it out to multiple news outlets and fanned the flames. Now, that's at Record 77, page 8 to 18, the description of all the things that he did.
I just wonder, Mr. Weber, how many negative emails and letters and telephone calls Professor McAdams has received ever since the university took its actions. It's simply a rhetorical question. Right.
So, counsel, I'd like you to return to the nature of the tribunal. A note in section 307.07 sub 1, the FHC is described as serving as the advisory body in cases of contested appointment, non-renewal, and suspension or termination, right?
Correct.
Okay. And this advisory body, when it finishes with its work, it sends a recommendation to the president.
Correct, yes.
And the president is not bound by the recommendation that it receives from the FHC. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. So what we have here, it appears, is a contract dispute between two parties, Dr. McAdams and the university. And if I understand your argument correctly, you're saying that Dr. McAdams is bound by the facts and conclusions of the report, but the university is not.
The university, which is the Academic Senate on the one hand and the administration on the other, absolutely is bound to these as well, in that if the Faculty Hearing Committee does its job in a slipshod way, and or if the president doesn't have a satisfactory explanation as to why he is disregarding the recommendation of the Faculty Hearing Committee, then on review, tested at judicial level, those things can come into account.
All right.
That is the deal that is struck between these parties.
Yeah, so I want to test the mutuality of the authority of this FHC report, right? So we're told as courts that we are to defer to the administration's decision on how it resolved this dispute because of this report. We're supposed to defer to that. And we're told that Dr. McAdams is bound by the conclusions of that report, but that the president, who changed the recommendations of the report and added conditions that were not contained in the report, he's not bound by it. Why is it that we would defer to a tribunal that binds one party and not the other?
Because of the structure that was created. And it starts with, in your question earlier, it starts with Record 53 at age 18, which is the contractual definition of academic freedom, which is both rights and responsibilities. So there is this defined term, academic freedom. And then, of course, there are disputes that will occasionally arise about how do you get that resolved. And the parties agree, the Academic Senate on the one hand and the administration on the other, that when there are disputes over academic freedom and dismissal, this is the body that it goes through. And the reason for that, and one of the most important, least understood parts of academic freedom, is institutional self-governance. That what the Academy believes is matters of academic freedom are best resolved within the Academy by the people who live it on a day-to-day basis.
Why is that not justiciable? Why can't we as a court look at that and decide whether that's true? This is just a contract dispute. I mean, this is not a complicated thing. It's just a contract.
It is a contract with a mutually agreed dispute resolution, disciplinary resolution mechanism. And I've heard this court say, I've heard Justice Rogenstein say, what this court is really good at is judging other judges. That's your job, to see if the judges below have done their job well. In this agreed mechanism, the Academy says, when it comes to living up to your obligations under academic freedom, your rights and your responsibilities, those matters are best resolved by people who live in that world. The professors who day to day say, this is appropriate conduct, and this is not.
Right. One of those professors on the FHC wrote a letter in advance of the hearing stating, quote, we support Ms. Abate and deeply regret she has experienced harassment and intimidation as a direct result of McAdams' actions. How is it fair, Mr. Weber, to have someone who prejudged a case if we are going to defer to such a tribunal and sit in judgment of Professor McAdams' conduct? I mean, would Marquette want a member of the FHC who wrote a letter saying we support Professor McAdams and deeply regret he has experienced harassment and intimidation as a direct result of Marquette University's actions?
So I have four facts for you in response. Number one, it's the Academic Senate, not the administration, that selects the members of the faculty hearing committee. Number two, the test for bias is actual, not appearance. Number three.
You don't think that demonstrated actual bias against Professor McAdams?
Well, it's not my call, because number three is it's expressly assigned to the faculty hearing committee as to make that call. And number four, and I actually have five, number four is it's a discretionary call, and attached to the faculty hearing committee report is the pre-hearing letter in which Law Professor Boyden goes into careful detail about this is not the judicial standard for recusal, but it is a juror standard for bias. And fifth and finally, Marquette needed four votes the administration needed four votes to prevail. It got all seven. It was unanimous.
Well, we probably wouldn't let a juror sit on a case before us who said before the matter was heard that he or she believed the defendant was guilty. Even though there may be 12 jurors on the case, we would strike it down and make them start over.
Well, I would urge you to look at Professor Boyden's letter where he goes into detail and he says, again, in this mutually agreed disciplinary process, that by definition, when something has become controversial enough on campus to result in the gathering of a faculty hearing committee, that there are going to be faculty members across the campus that are aware, some of whom have opinions about it. And as he describes there, it was a reasoned decision as to why they allowed her to continue.
In addition to what the Chief Justice just pointed out, we also generally don't allow juries to decide questions of law, right? And construction of a contract is a question of law, yes?
Well, this was the application. Well, yes.
Okay. So why is it that we would need to defer to the FHC's construction of the contract when we would not do that with any other party? And in particular, we don't defer to the circuit courts that we review when they make decisions on questions of law.
Well, you do defer when you have contracts that include arbitration clauses. That's one of the reasons that the MMAC is interested in this case. That's one of the reasons that National Association of Manufacturers is interested in this case.
Yeah.
Because there is an agreement between the parties that the people at the ground level, the people who live academic freedom on a day-to-day basis, that they're in the best position to decide what does academic freedom mean in this context and what does conduct mean in this context.
Right, but the reason that we defer to arbitrations, and I would quibble a little bit with the whether it's deference or not, arbitration is a contractual agreement to allow a third party to resolve a dispute. And so we don't really defer to it. We simply enforce the contract between the parties. And here, I haven't seen in all of the briefing and in all of the documents, I haven't seen anything that indicates that there was an agreement that the FHC would be the exclusive tribunal by which to resolve disputes between the university and the professor. There's nothing in the faculty statutes. There's nothing in the contract. There's nothing in the AUUP. Where are we supposed to find that agreement that Dr. McAdams agreed that the FHC would have the last word on this?
I would say you find it in the very essence of this mutually agreed deal.
But in any other context, have we ever looked to essence as a basis for saying that a person has given up his right to have a contract reviewed by a court.
I think you all the time, this court says, what were the parties trying to accomplish? What were they trying to get at here? And if you look at it through that lens, how could it be that you would have a faculty hearing committee of seven from across the university put together a report with 300 findings of fact to the clear and convincing evidence standard, unanimously decide, you know, in our world, we don't do this to students.
Sure. One of the things that the parties usually are attempting to accomplish, either through the arbitration process or any other contractually agreed upon dispute resolution matter, is a fair procedure, procedurally fair way to resolve their difference. And as one of the affidavits that was submitted to the Milwaukee County Circuit Court indicates, there may be some material facts that, according to your answer to me previously, you may have slipped your mind or wasn't foremost in your record. The affidavit of Brian McGrath, who was one of the attorneys for Professor McAdams, in his page 3 of his affidavit, which was received by the circuit court, I have the filing stamp, paragraph 14, the FHC, this is the fair tribunal that was supposed to be arbitrating this dispute, well, not arbitrating, but disposing of it, was told that Abate left Marquette due to concerns for her physical safety and transferred to another university to complete her PhD, substantially impacting her academic progress. Neither the FHC nor Professor McAdams were provided with any of the following documents which show that she left for other reasons. 1. On December 9, 2014, Dr. South, Associate Dean, wrote in an email that Abate was, quote, not just leaving because of McAdams, but because she did not feel comfortable in the department for several reasons, not least because of how Nancy Snow treated her, her research area, and her mentor, Suzanne Foster. And then there's a cite to the Marquette record. 2. In that same email, South commented on the harm allegedly caused by Professor McAdams and said, quote, none of the senior faculty she mentioned have been harmed by McAdams in the way she suggests. Indeed, I've always felt much more annoyed by Nancy Snow than by anything McAdams said, and I've seen her intimidate and belittle her colleagues more than McAdams ever has done. 3. Ms. Abate transferred to the University of Colorado. She had expressed interest in transferring and finishing her PhD there a year earlier, but was not able to do so because there was no room for her. Citation to the Marquette record. Dr. South described the transfer to Dean Holtz by explaining that Ms. Abate was transferring to a program that, quote, offered her significant financial aid and is reputationally superior to Marquette University. Citation to the Marquette record. Finally, Ms. Abate herself said that, quote, honestly, in light of all that has happened, I am very thankful that McAdams started this attack because it prompted Boulder to reach out to me and offered to transfer me to their program. Besides Boulder being a much better program in philosophy than Marquette, I absolutely love Colorado and cannot wait to move back there permanently. Period, end quote, and then citation to the Marquette record. So it seems to me that there might be more to the story than what the FHC either had at its hands or turned over to at least one of the attorneys representing Professor McAdams.
I would say this, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
First of all, the trial court was aware of this material and said
evidently,
that...
Evidently, yes.
Right, and said that while there was a dispute, they were not material to the issue before him mm-hmm. of Professor McAdams violating his duties as a professor
right.
as found by his tenured peers and the president of the university.
Sure, I'll just note in passing, they were relevant to what I was asking you about 15 minutes ago.
Yes, you're right. And the court was aware of those things and talked about it and said they were not material to the issues that were before the board. And against those core concepts of shared governance, academic freedom.
Yeah, and you're also talking about a circuit court that decided to accept the FHC report, to accept between two lines of reasoning in the federal court system, one that accepts these kinds of reports and adopts them as their own, and one line of reasoning that rejects that and says, no, as a circuit court, I will not accept FHC type findings, and instead I will act as an independent judge and conduct my own hearing. This circuit court decided on the former and rejected the latter. So by definition, all of the things that you said would be true.
He followed the Yackshaw line of cases,
right,
also followed by the Seventh Circuit, to say...
The Seventh Circuit follows McConnell.
No. No, the Columbia College case, they did a limited deferential review. And because, otherwise, going back to what were they trying to accomplish, does it make sense to go through all this, to go through over a year and a half of work within the university pursuant to an agreed process, and then say, we're going to throw it all out, and now let's start over de novo and ask 12 lay jurors from Milwaukee County to decide, did you live up to your obligations as set forth in the academic freedom? Did you live up to your obligations as set forth in 306, 02, and 03? And what he found was, and I urge this court to find, it doesn't make sense to throw out this mutually agreed process.
Well, maybe
that's
maybe
how the parties agreed by contract to accept the decision of the faculty review board. Professor McAdams or any other faculty who has a similar contract never agreed to accept that, right? They have rights to judicial review.
It says you get to test the validity, and that's what happened in, for example, in the Seventh Circuit in Columbia College, and that's why we're here today. This is the fourth level of review of this matter. We had the faculty hearing committee, you had President Lovell on behalf of the administration, you had the trial court, and now we have this court. That's
so
four levels of review.
Yeah, so one more thing on the on that first level of review. So that was, the FHC was comprised professors from the university, yes?
Across the university, well, dental school, law school, engineering, yes.
Yeah, they're all university employees.
All of them tenured members of the faculty, yes.
Yeah. Employees of the university.
Yes.
Okay. And so in a contract dispute between the professor and the university, his case was judged by the university's employees, right?
The shared governance deal that was struck between the AUP and the AAC provided for exactly that.
Right. So,
yes.
So my concern is, generally speaking, for the last 400 years, we have looked down on arrangements in which a person could be the judge of his own cause. And wasn't Marquette the judge of its own cause in this case?
No. It was a mutually agreed disciplinary process with elected tenured faculty on the one hand, the administration on the other, subject to judicial review to make sure, A, the process was followed fairly, and that there was substantial evidence in the record to support the outcome, to a clear and convincing evidence standard, 300 findings of fact, and 123 pages.
Thank you.
Professor, I'd ask you to begin by discussing, at least for a minute or so, the line of cases in regard to the judicial acceptance of findings of fact and conclusions of law of committees such as the FHC, as opposed to that line of cases which rejects.
They're based on contract. Yackshaw said that the parties had agreed that this was an exclusive forum. When universities have asked, because it's an assurance to faculty that they ought to be able to speak freely.
What you
and
mean,
to say, to make those colleagues the judge of what you can say is contrary to the very nature of academic freedom. And so saying that, well, there's nothing in the contract that says that this is ADR or says this is arbitration. Marquette has great lawyers, and if it wanted to have an ADR or an arbitration provision, it certainly would know how to put that in there. But to say that we can apply this from the essence or the chassis or for whatever it is, I think is not only inconsistent with the way that this court normally handles situations
when you
like
say,
this. You don't make the contract that the parties didn't make, but it's also
when you
inconsistent
say, Professor,
with the protection provided.
That
I'm
the
sorry.
You don't look that sorry, but I let it go. When you say that academic freedom is a protection against your colleagues, what I think you mean, and what I hear you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it is a firewall to protect those academics who may express opinions which are contrary to those that are popularly expressed by their colleagues.
Yes, I agree with that. That's exactly what it is. And so when we look at the contract and we look at this thing, and Marquette, again, they didn't have to make these promises. Private institutions don't have to make them. They don't want to make them. They want to be able to fire their employees for what they say. They're absolutely free to do this. They just have to refrain from saying, promising that they won't. So when you look and you construe the promise that they made, and that's what we're about here, I think it's fascinating to think about whether academic freedom is coterminous with the First Amendment protection. I think both protections were there. I think that they're very, very close. But I do agree that it's an interesting question to ask whether they're the same or not. But however they cash out and however we look at them, when someone writes a blog post on a matter of great public concern, about someone within the university committee who has exercised their authority in a way that that individual thinks is inconsistent with the guiding values of the university and inconsistent with the nature of academic discourse at a college campus. And the post that they write is not rude, it's not vituperative, it's not ad hominem, it doesn't call on anybody to do anything to anybody. It names the person that is being criticized, but of course that's common. We always do that.
Professor
and
Eisenberg,
as is common.
I apologize for interrupting, but before your time expires, I want you to address something because, as you know, this court has received multiple amicus briefs, primarily from business interests who are concerned that this court will create a speech right that would override or supersede the provisions of private employer-employee contracts. In fact, Marquette University took out an ad on page 7 of yesterday's Wall Street Journal, quoting from the MMAC's friend of the court brief. Are you asking this court to supersede the provisions of a private employer-employee contract?
Absolutely not. In this context, we're simply asking that the contract be enforced. If Marquette doesn't want to make these commitments to its employees, it doesn't have to do so. If other private institutions don't want to make these commitments to their employees, they don't have to do so. And for the most part, they don't. I don't know any foundries or law firms or accounting firms that make commitments like this. Marquette chose this. They chose it because they thought it was consistent with their mission. And quite frankly, if they didn't do it, that it would hurt their reputation and they wouldn't be able to attract the kind of faculty that they want. And so this case, this case is about this court enforcing the agreement that the parties made. The parties did not agree to arbitration or alternative dispute resolution. They did not agree that this would be exclusive. For the court to imply that.
What specifically are you asking us to do, and what rule do you want to have articulated as a result of this case?
We are asking this court to reverse the grant of summary judgment to Marquette University, finding that there was no agreement to make this exclusive. My red light is on. May I?
You may certainly finish your answer.
reverse the grant of summary judgment in favor of Marquette University, finding that there's nothing in the agreement that made this the exclusive forum, and there's nothing in the law of the state of Wisconsin from which it can be applied. Then, reverse the circuit court's denial of summary judgment to Dr. McAdams, because however we interpret these broad guarantees of academic freedom and the First Amendment protection against termination, this blog post is squarely within that protection. There's no issue of material fact. Summary judgment should be entered for Dr. McAdams. He should be reinstated to the faculty of Marquette University, and the case should be remanded for determination of damages.
Okay. Well, your last comment is interesting, but your red light is on, so I won't challenge you on it at this moment. Very interesting argument and really, really interesting questions. I think we had 10 or 12 amicus briefs from everyone. A lot of professors from a lot of universities are very interested in this, as you might imagine that they would be. So thank you for an interesting argument. We are going to adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 10 minutes after 3 o'clock. Thank you very much.